This is The Agenda. Local newsmakers, community leaders, and people in our valley making a difference. Here's your host, Dave Bernstein.
All right, thanks for joining us on this Monday, and we are back on the line with State Senator Brad Hawkins, who is about to kick off the 12th Legislative District listening tour, and this is the fifth year for this event. Seems like you only started it about a year or so ago. So, Senator Hawkins, thanks for joining us. This is an opportunity to get around to make contact with as many people as you can, particularly in some of the outlying areas. So it's tomorrow and Wednesday, I understand.
Yeah, well, first off, Dave, thank you so much for having me on. It's always great to be on KPQ and The Agenda with you. I'm very excited about my fifth annual listening tour. It was something I started soon after I first got elected to the state Senate, and it was sort of an opportunity to connect with constituents where they are in their communities, traveling around the district. And as you know, the 12th Legislative District is very large geographically. It reaches into four counties: Chelan, Douglas, Grant, and Okanagan. And it was a new idea that I started 5 years ago, and the constituents of the 12th District have really sort of taken to it. It's a great opportunity for them to sort of provide me feedback about state government or even legislative ideas or budget requests. And we've had a great turnout. Normally, I spend almost a week traveling around the whole district. Last year, we did it virtually because of COVID on Zoom. This year, I was hoping to do a mix of in-person and virtual meetings, but with the recent mask mandates and things, I decided to just switch it back to total virtual meetings, which we're holding September 14th and 15th, so this Tuesday and Wednesday, and we have a lot of appointments lined up with a lot of different local governments, business groups, and different stakeholders, and look forward to connecting with people again via Zoom this year.
Now, are all the appointments filled at this point? It does start tomorrow, so is that all spoken for?
We're pretty stacked up, but there are actually a few appointments, I think, on Wednesday afternoon. So I don't believe we have any individual appointments for individuals, but we still have some appointments for some larger groups. And if people in their businesses or their associations or different stakeholder groups want to meet with me, we do have a few appointments still available. It's really good to have these meetings. Some of the groups I meet with every year, for example, the Chelan Douglas Land Trust, I've met with them 5 years in a row, and a lot of other groups, local government officials and whatnot. But it's really nice to sort of have these discussions, individually with these different groups of stakeholders in the fall, well before the legislative session, so that if there are budget requests or legislative ideas that come from it, we have an opportunity to do the due diligence, do the research, come up with the legislative language, and really make a run for some of these budget requests or bill ideas. And like I said, we have had some success with that in the past. But also, if people have questions about state government or things that, I usually have the staff members with me or issue specialists from Olympia participating, and if we can't answer people's questions right there during the listening tour, we take down the information, do the research, and then follow up with them with the answers. It's listening, the developing your listening skills and being able to respond to constituents with the good amount of customer service is something I really take a lot of pride in. A lot of people often ask me, well, as state senator, what's the most important part of your job? Is it public speaking? And while public speaking is important and being on the radio with you and a lot of these other opportunities to get my message out, that's really important. But really, I think the most important quality and skill set for a legislator, or really for anybody, frankly, is your listening skills.
So if someone wanted to get in touch with your office to see if their group might be able to still get an opportunity to participate tomorrow or Wednesday, how do they do that? Do they call or do they reach out via email?
Probably best at this point to contact me via email. So my legislative email is brad.hawkins@leg.wa.gov. Again, that's brad.hawkins@leg.wa.gov. www.senatorbradhawkins.org or through my website, which is senatorbradhawkins.org. We're pretty much full on Tuesday. We're mostly full on Wednesday, but I think there are some slots still open for groups on Wednesday. So if there are any folks out there who do want to participate and get something together, well, you know, we're happy to do that, and we're happy to provide you the technology details. And if by chance the Zoom meetings don't work well for you, and I can respect that, we can just do a traditional telephone conference call, and that seems to work very well, too.
We're talking with State Senator Brad Hawkins, and the 5th Annual Listening Tour is tomorrow and Wednesday. And give us an idea of whether it's been legislation that's actually, or something, an idea that actually resulted in legislation, or an idea for a bill that you're able to move forward, or some ideas that you're trying to craft into legislation that have come out of these. Give us two or three that really come to your mind.
Sure. Well, one of the very first ones that I recall was when I met with the City of Leavenworth officials. They had issues disposing of brush and yard clippings following this renewed line, this moved border for the Apple Maggot quarantine line. And anyway, to make a long story short, they had issues disposing of brush and yard waste within their city limits, and I was able to pass a law that gave them a little more flexibility in doing that, and that went all the way to the governor's desk. That first or second year, too, I also met with the Chelan Douglas Land Trust, and they brought an issue to me about wanting to renovate the Saddle Rock trails, the trails up to Saddle Rock. We have a new Saddle Rock Gateway Trailhead, which is really great, but it's a pretty steep uphill if a lot of folks have hiked up Saddle Rock, and there's no emergency access pass. But basically, to do any ground-disturbing work up there to renovate the trails, we have to remove some of the arsenic and lead and some of the trace elements from the old mining. So basically, I had to secure a grant for the City of Wenatchee to do some of that work, and the City of Wenatchee is doing that work now, and soon the trail will be renovated. I had a person come to me up in Okanagan County at one of the stops, and he's an avid winter fisherman. And he likes to do this winter fishing at this lake called Leader Lake up in Okanagan County within the district. And he said, I just can't get there because the WDFW doesn't plow the roads. Well, after the listening tour meeting, we contacted WDFW. Turns out that the Department of Natural Resources actually owns and operates that lake. And the WDFW stocks the lake with fish, but the road was in major need of repair and just couldn't be plowed. And so to make a long story short, it took me a couple years, but we secured the funding to renovate the road, that half-mile stretcher road, as a funding request to the DNR. And now the WDFW is able to not only plow it, they're able to stock that really popular winter fishing lake, and this gentleman and a lot of other people from Okanagan County and beyond are able to enjoy their winter fishing. So those are just a few different ideas. This last legislative session, I secured some funding for a biochar project in the Methow Valley so that they could do a demonstration project to help reduce our risk of wildfire up there. And I also secured some funding for the City of Wenatchee's Community Center, which is utilized by the Pinnacle Prep Charter School. That's $2.5 million of funding we secured for the City of Wenatchee to do renovations at the community center, and Pinnacle's Prep Charter School will benefit from that. And all of those things I talked about, Dave, those are all examples of things that constituents brought to me and that were first discussed during past listening tours. And like I said, it's not just legislative ideas or budget requests. It's generally just people's comments or questions about state government, and you know, we're able to answer those questions as well. So it's really, really valuable to connect with people. I wish I could connect with people in their separate communities, because we've been all over the district and there are so many different small towns. I probably wouldn't even have time to mention them here, but Unfortunately, sure. We're going to be doing them virtual this year, but it works really well with the Zoom technology.
Well, let me ask you this. What's the most effective use of the time? Is it better for people to come with an idea or a problem? Because I think all of us would probably say, hey, I have a concern about mandates, or I have a concern that not enough people are getting vaccinated, or we all have concerns about something. What do you find, have you been doing this for 4 years, this is the fifth annual, is the most effective use of the listening tour with each group that you're with, that maybe they come with a problem that they've identified, and maybe here's our basic idea. What could the legislature do? What do you find has been the most effective process to go through?
Well, I definitely think that's effective if the stakeholder group has an idea of something they want to accomplish. But, you know, my idea with the listening tour is it's difficult for people to get to Olympia. It's often, especially in the winter, when they're traveling over two mountain passes in the middle of winter. And I just like this idea of having your legislator be accessible to you. The people who elect you to serve, I think, you know, for me, it's so important for people to know that I value your input, because you collectively, as the people of the 12th district, you are my boss. And so it is helpful if people come with a general idea, or, you know, how could we work? Can I brainstorm with you about this strategy to get this accomplished? And could you come back to us with legislative language or things like that? But also, I just really invite people to come and share what's on your mind and on your heart. And, you know, that's really helpful for me as a legislator. And it's been, both have been very effective.
Okay.
A lot of people are able to share things with you in person or as a small group that they're not as easily able to fully articulate through an email or a letter. And so it's really just the constituents' time to share their thoughts and feedback or questions or concerns about state government with me.
Okay. Well, we'll take a break here, and we have Senator Hawkins with us for the full hour. You did a survey and got quite the response rate on COVID vaccine. So we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. Want to talk as well about something that I think that may be catching a lot of folks unaware, and that is the long-term care tax. So we'll get to that probably in our next segment here. Well, we have Senator Brad Hawkins. We've been talking about his listening tour, which starts Tuesday and Wednesday. But I would guess that somehow, some way, the issue of mandates or the COVID vaccine measures and mandates that have been in place, maybe we'll come up with one of your groups or executive powers somehow, some way. I think some of this may come up with some of the groups that you're going to be talking with. But you did do a survey, Senator Hawkins, and you get quite the response. It was basically a COVID vaccine survey. It had a lot to do with many of the elements surrounding that. So were you surprised to get that much feedback, or is that typical with any surveys you've done out of your legislative office?
Boy, I mean, I asked for people's feedback, and we got it. This went above and beyond the typical response that I receive on the surveys. I sort of anticipated that there could be a lot of interest in this survey, because in the 2 days, Dave, that the 48 hours following Governor Inslee's recent vaccine mandates for K-12 employees and some other masking requirements and things, my office received almost 3,000 emails from constituents in that 48-hour period. And when I issued the survey, we sent it out to about 51,000 people on my distribution list. We received 6,500 responses. And also, in addition to the yes or no questions that we were asked, that nearly 6,500 people responded to, We also have an option for additional comments. And I received, as part of this survey, approximately 4,300 additional comments, some multiple paragraphs long, in response to the survey. And so I was just really grateful that people would take the time to participate. And again, this sort of thing is kind of consistent with my approach to being a lawmaker, is I want to hear from people. You know, I want to be a good listener. I want to give my constituents an opportunity to share feedback with me. And these surveys at the right time have proven to be, you know, good tools for that. And the results are, of course, are very interesting as well.
And your results, one of your questions, I am looking at a little bit of the information here, it had to do with whether or not if you're in one of those classifications that is a mandate for vaccination here by the middle of next month, essentially, or face termination, there was a resounding, I guess, no support for that among. What did your numbers come out? Have you got them there?
Yeah, I do. The numbers show that a strong majority of the respondents, about 60% to 40%, believe that school districts and state employees, as well as healthcare workers, you know, and others, should not be required to receive the COVID vaccine as a condition of their employment. So it was split 60%, you know, felt no, and 40%, I'll acknowledge, did feel that state employees and school district officials should be required to be vaccinated as a condition of their employment. And so 60%, 40% split was kind of interesting. That was the same split when I asked a question later in the survey about whether Governor Inslee's vaccine mandate should include a personal or philosophical exemption in addition to the medical and religious exemptions. But also, I asked questions about school masking, and to the school masking question, 44% responded that students should not be required to wear masks for the first half of the year. 56% responded no to that, but there were 44% in support of school masking, at least for the first half of the year. So it kind of got to get interesting once I started to ask questions beyond the vaccine mandates. And for example, nearly 48% responded yes to the question of whether unvaccinated people should be required to wear masks indoors. There's still a majority of people, 52%, that said no, but it did surprise me how close it was that nearly half of the people responded that unvaccinated people, at least at this time, you know, should be wearing masks indoors.
Did you have a question on your survey that had anything to do with whether or not those who face one of these vaccine mandates in order to keep their job would be should be entitled to get unemployment benefits? From everything I've seen, that's not the case. And I asked this question because those that were afraid to go to work back in the beginnings of the pandemic, granted we did not have a COVID vaccine then, but the fear of going back to work because of COVID was a fear of COVID. In this case, it would be folks deciding they don't want to get the vaccine could easily argue, I have a fear of getting the vaccine, whether or not it's been FDA approved or not, yet they would be rejected to get unemployment benefits that that they have contributed towards. So seems to be kind of a different treatment there.
Yes, and I did ask that question. The question I posed specifically was, if public employees lose their job because of their refusal to get vaccinated, should they be eligible for state and federal unemployment benefits? And nearly 62% responded yes, and only 38% responded no. So there was strong support that people would be able to qualify for state and federal unemployment benefits if they refused to get vaccinated, or if they didn't qualify for some of these existing exemptions. I also asked the question, which I found this result a bit interesting, should private businesses, again, we're not talking about the government, we're talking about private businesses, coffee shops, restaurants, airlines, should they be allowed to ask customers to show their vaccination cards or refuse service? And 42% said yes, but again, we had nearly 58% responding no. That the 58% of the people responding to the survey do not even want the private businesses to be allowed to be able to refuse people because of a lack of a vaccination. So I did find that interesting. Again, you know, a question like that, for example, nearly 43% responded yes. So you got to acknowledge that 43% is a significant number as well. So it just kind of, I think the survey shows that kind of much like America, things are really divided right now, and I know there are strong opinions on all sides, and my hope personally is that we can kind of figure out a way to kind of move forward together to despite the differences. But I kind of feel like, well, maybe we need to stop trying to convince the other sides, regardless of however we feel on these different issues, because I don't really think people are being convinced, and it is creating a lot of heartburn and disruption among people. And again, this survey, you know, it's not a scientific survey, so I should just sort of acknowledge that. But to get 6,500 responses from people in the district over just a week or two period of time was pretty substantial. And so I have a lot of faith in the results that the survey generated.
What about, does any of this do, and I'm sure maybe other legislators on both sides of the aisle have surveyed their districts and how their voters feel about this. Does any of this having any impact on any legislation to change the governor's emergency powers?
Well, I'm not sure about the emergency powers. I think, you know, we have an outdated law related to the emergency powers in our state. We need to modify that. I'd like to have a check and balance with the state legislature. So, for example, I think we've discussed this before. If the governor uses his executive authority to issue an emergency proclamation for 30 or 45 days, to me, that's fine. That the executive branch should have that authority during states of emergency. No one anticipated an emergency that's nearly 2 years long, but in this case, after those initial 30 or 45 days, I think it is very reasonable to require, if that's to be extended beyond 30 or 45 days, then the legislature needs to be called to a special session to approve that. I think that would be helpful. Now, whether other legislators are at, I guess I don't know. I certainly appreciate the feedback I'm getting from people in our district. And one of the reasons I am asking it, Dave, is because I believe vaccines and vaccine policy is going to be a big, big issue for many years in the future, not only in the state of Washington, but across America. We had an issue a few years ago, a bill that was brought to the legislature about removing the personal and philosophical exemption from a K-12 student's requirements on vaccines. I support having a personal and philosophical exemption in addition to medical and religious exemptions, but what you're seeing now with the governor's mandates and potentially other states across the United States is the removal of the personal or philosophical exemption from those requirements, just sort of limiting people's exemptions. And I think we're going to see either more of that activity in state policy in the state of Washington in future years, or eventually we're going to see a bill before the legislature mandating the vaccine for K-12 workers, mandating the vaccine for state employees, or mandating the vaccine potentially, like President Biden did, for businesses over a certain number of employees, private businesses. So I think we're going to see a lot of discussion, not to mention the addition potentially of the COVID vaccine for all K-12 students eventually once the vaccines are eligible for all the students. So I no doubt, you know, this is leading to a lot of major topics of discussion on this issue in the years ahead. And it's good for me to get a snapshot at least of where our constituents are at the present time on this.
Have you got your full survey results on your website for this vaccine survey?
Yes, we do. We released it in a news release last week. And so that news release with the link to the full results is on my website at senatorbradhawkins.org under news. But also, we'll be sending out a link to the full results in an email update this Wednesday. So I'll be sending that out, and I'll also be in that email newsletter, I'll be also answering a lot of other questions too. I've received so many inquiries from constituents about this. Normally my process, Dave, is to try to be very personalized and respond to each, and sometimes I'm handwriting notes and all these things, but there's just been an extraordinary amount of communications over the past month or two. And so what I'm doing in this next email newsletter to the 51,000 people and beyond is to say, hey, here are some of the frequently asked questions that I've been receiving. Here's my answers to some of these about emergency powers, about whether these mandates are constitutional, about how is this, you know, executive authority even possible, or about the police reforms and the surveys. And so I'm sharing all that information, and the link to the full results of the survey will be included in that email newsletter here in a couple days.
Okay, we'll take a break here and come back and talk about long-term care tax that is going to be coming up, and a few other items. I see way down on my list here, a special session. Would it be possible? And we'll get to all of that. State Senator Brad Hawkins with us this hour on the agenda. There is a long-term care tax that we will be paying into that all accounts that I've heard from is not a very very good deal. And in fact, from everything I've heard, I don't know how this passed, and so there's all kinds of challenges to it in terms of it being equitable for anyone. So first off, explain a little bit, Senator Hawkins, and how did this come to pass? Because I would think that we would have things like the insurance commissioner looking out for us on this.
Yeah, well, this is a difficult one. You know, there are so many things that passed this legislative session. You know, all the police reforms, the cap and trade climate bill, and the capital gains income tax, and so many things were moving forward. And this was actually a bill that came through in 2019, but a continuation a little bit this year. But it was House Bill 1087, and it requires all Washington State workers to pay into a new long-term care program that will be established in our state. And this is regardless of whether you'll actually benefit from it. And that's the tough thing. And I voted against this bill, but it did pass the State House of Representatives by a vote of 63-33. And it passed the State Senate a little closer, by a vote of 26-22. Again, I voted against it. It's basically it would establish this long-term care program with a maximum benefit of about $36,000. So that's a maximum lifetime benefit that you would qualify for if you pay into the system long enough. But the program itself is funded by a payroll tax. So the state of Washington will be taxing your paycheck with 58 cents every $100 of earnings. So like $5.80 for every $1,000 of earnings. And basically, all workers, and this is especially troubling and burdensome for younger workers, because they're going to be paying potentially into this program through their paychecks, their whole working career, which could be the next 40 years, and they may never actually need long-term care insurance. And if they do, you know, they're only going to be having a lifetime maximum benefit of $36,500. So this is a tough bill that passed. I imagine there'll be many changes to it, but there are a lot of younger people kind of working from paycheck to paycheck. They're struggling to repay their student loans or saving for a house. A lot of older individuals too that need every dollar from their paychecks. And again, this is the government reaching its hand into your paycheck, your private paycheck of your earnings, in addition to all the other taxes and things, and saying that, you know, we're going to do this for you because we believe it's important for you potentially later on.
Well, I understand, and in fact, we've heard this issue discussed on other programs as well. What if you move? What if you retire elsewhere?
Well, yeah, you're not. To answer that question, then you're not eligible for this benefit.
So the money stays here. The benefit stays here, and it doesn't travel with you.
Right. It's not portable, as we say, and of course, there could be changes down the road to make it portable, but then there's a question of whether the program as it was originally structured and envisioned, will it be solvent if we allow people to take their benefits to some other state, and how do we actually implement that properly? So there's not a portability component to it. If someone, for example, lives in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, but works in Spokane, they're going to be taxed on something throughout their whole working career that they're not going to receive benefit for. But I do want to say, Dave, that we should mention that ensuring that our elderly population has access to quality long-term care, that is a very important issue. And I don't mean to in any way minimize the importance of the issue by my opposition to this particular law, but this kind of sets up this big government program, and I don't believe a lot of people will benefit from it, and then people that do benefit from it, we know, for those of you that have relatives or family or friends receiving long-term care, it can be very, very costly. And so $36,500 of a lifetime benefit may not be enough for most of the people receiving long-term care. So it's a tough issue, and the private sector does offer long-term care insurance currently. So for the government to set up a program of its own is a bit duplicative, to say the least, in addition to potential inefficiencies with the government program. But it'll be interesting to see how this all gets sorted out over the next several years. But it will. There is an option right now. There's a window of opportunity for people if they want to secure private long-term care insurance through a private provider. They can do that and apply for an exemption to this program if they do it by November 1st of this year. And if not, then that window closes.
Well, $36,000 would mostly be wiped out within a year, I would think, of long-term care. And secondly, like you say, you've got that window of opportunity, and you could go on to the private market, but I understand those options are becoming very, very limited as well. So it just doesn't sound like this was crafted at all. And I just wonder where the insurance commissioner was on this.
Well, it's interesting. I have some issues with the insurance commissioner as well about the other things he's doing to kind of monkey with insurance rates. And I've actually received a lot of feedback from constituents in opposition to this upcoming long-term care tax, but as well as potential increases in their insurance rates for other issues too that the insurance commissioner has been involved in. So again, this is troubling. I mean, over time, we're able to save less and less of our own hard earnings, and more goes for the government to be redistributed. Throughout our state, and it's difficult. You know, the people who can afford to pay are not going to be able to afford to pay for all the things for everybody else that's receiving the benefit. And so it's a difficult situation. I'm not sure how this is going to pencil out, but like I said, I think the insurance commissioner has his his plate pretty full about hearing from constituents on this other issue as well, which I'd be happy to talk about if you want.
Was this just crafted to be able to supplement how much money we can provide to subsidize long-term care for the entire general population, or was this crafted basically be my benefit account as I pay into it? Because there is some good to helping provide that subsidy to help those that are already in need. But if it was packaged so that it's my benefit account, it's not going to pay off for me.
No, it's not your benefit account. It's a tax that is being collected to fund a state program. A state program that will likely need to be expanded, and in which the tax will likely grow on you, into your paychecks, into your pocketbook. And to answer your previous question, I think it's intended to be both. There's a certain period of time where some people only need long-term care for maybe a year, in which case this $36,000 might cover a portion of that. But the people who need care longer or need more high-quality care, they could potentially use this to supplement their care, or they could use this and purchase a long-term care insurance plan through their private provider and kind of use some combinations of both. But I guess what I'm saying is these options for long-term care insurance do exist within the private market. I before this bill passed, I didn't hear about any complaints about people not being able to access long-term care or life insurance or any of the other things through private insurance. But the government in this state, Washington State, wants to step in and create its own program for something like this. And again, that's not to minimize long-term care needs in our state. That's very big, and I know the federal government with Medicaid and Medicare is very involved with, you know, dealing with long-term care issues. And we need to make sure that people in the most need, you know, our loved ones in their final years, that they're receiving the services that they need. But I just don't support this and the reaching into people's paychecks to grab a handful of their earnings for the remainder of the lifetime of their working career for something they may never use, or their life circumstances may take them to another state and their family may have to up and move and relocate, and they'll never receive the benefit of something that they've been paying into.
Well, let's move on to one other insurance item, and that is, I know the insurance commissioner, I understand, is looking at credit scores and how that is factored into the insurance premium that you pay. So what can you update us on that?
Yeah, so again, this is Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler. You know, he's been proposing and pursuing different legislation in past years to prohibit the use of credit scores for personal insurance rates. So, for example, people who have home insurance, renter's insurance, auto insurance, the insurance commissioner is involved in the regulation of those rates, and the private insurers sort of submit what their proposed rates are. And there has been past legislation. In fact, this last session in 2021, there was Senate Bill 5010 that was requested by the Office of the Insurance Commissioner, Commissioner Mike Kreidler, that would have outright outlawed and prohibited the use of credit scores for personal insurance rate setting. And that, and I didn't support that bill, and it didn't advance. But after that unsuccessful effort at passing that legislation through the legislature, Commissioner Kreidler issued an emergency rule to temporarily prohibit the use of credit scores, and he wants to utilize his office's rulemaking authority to extend that rule for up to 3 years and then still work on this legislation. And the reason I just don't think that the state should be prohibiting the use of credit scores, utilizing credit scores has been for a long time a nationally accepted way to determine people's risks for submitting insurance claims. And basically, I kind of see this whole effort as a way to effectively punish people for having good credit. You know, good credit is something that I was taught as a kid. You know, work hard on your credit, have good credit, and if you qualify for loans, and you can, you know, if you work hard to pay off your debts and you achieve good credit, then you're gonna benefit. You know, and you should. But Commissioner Kreidler feels old, then that disproportionately impacts certain minority groups and lower income people and who have higher credit and stuff. And so basically I think he's essentially punishing people with good credit to implement this emergency rule. And there's actually, I don't think there's any evidence that would suggest anybody's cost of insurance will be reduced if he does this. But what I believe will actually happen, Dave, is that people with good credit, their cost of insurance will likely increase because the insurers can no longer factor that in to their risk management, right? And so they, in order to make up for that and just absorb that risk into the system, the insurance companies, I believe, will have to essentially charge everyone more to cover their potential risks. And that's why the people with good credit under this proposal from Commissioner Mike Kreidler will actually be potentially punished for their good credit.
All right.
Well, complicated issue, but hopefully I explained it okay.
Yeah, we can discuss actuarial tables next time. Cost of insurance ought to be things like your driving record, what it costs to repair your vehicle in your place. But they start to take a look at other things like where you live, or are people more accident prone there? And I've seen studies that they do take that into factors, take those things into factor as well, like where you live. There's some magic numbers in the whole equation. We're out of time, unfortunately, I hope you get some good ideas from folks with the listening tour, and maybe we'll see some legislation come of it. The listening tour with Senator Brad Hawkins tomorrow and Wednesday, and if you have a group that would like to maybe see if there's a slot left, again, one more time on your email address.
My email address is brad.hawkins@ledge.wa.gov. And if by chance people can't participate in the listening tour, you can contact me anytime through that email or through my website, which is senatorbradhawkins.org. Great to be on with you, Dave.
All right. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
You bet.